Welcome. Good morning. We are the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are a welcoming congregation. You're welcome here no matter who you love, where you are from, what brings you here, or what burdens you carry. We are a loving congregation. We recognize the universal light within each person, a light that binds us in our common humanity. I'm thrilled to see many guests and friends of the fellowship here this morning. Special welcome to all of you who are here, especially to hear our speaker, Ms. Terry Schmidt, today. We're fortunate to have the gifted artist, Teresa Tempero Schmidt, who I believe prefers to be called Terry, so I'll drop the formalities if that's appropriate, who will share images of her work and reflect upon the deeper meanings of art. In honor of Terry's work, for the chalice lighting, I've selected this verse by Lao Tse, which calls our attention to negative and positive space, to the seen and unseen, just as the flame of the chalice focuses our attention upon the unseen oxygen in this air. 30 spokes shares the wheel's hub. It is the center hole that makes it useful. Shape clay into a vessel. It is the space within that makes it useful. Cut doors and windows for a room. It is the holes that make them useful. Therefore, profit comes from what is there, usefulness from what is not there. Ruby, would you like to light the chalice? Please stand as you are able and join me in singing hymn 326, Let All the Beauty We Have Known. Please be seated. I'd like to call your attention to the announcements in our order of service today. There are several valuable announcements, and a couple of them I'm going to mention because they relate to our religious education program, and you may not have had a chance to read about them. We are beginning the series Popcorn Theology again. This is each Friday evening at 7 p.m., through August 14th. This is a series, a film and discussion series for middle and high school age students. It will be here at the Fellowship, and Carolyn Ferguson is facilitating that. Also today, the RE group has a very special field trip. They're headed to Tom and Monta Manny's homestead to explore their property and check in on our beehive out there. So if there are any parents of children here in the group today who have not already submitted a permission slip, you'll want to talk with Sandy Nelson right away after the children's story. Okay. In our tradition as a loving, caring fellowship, I invite you all to share joys and concerns with the rest of the group today. I think we've got a microphone in the back. Jessica Sievers is holding a microphone. Please share with us those things that have happened in your life this week, those blessings, and also those burdens.
I just want to introduce a couple friends who are sitting in the back, came for moral support, Marvin and Rebecca Gould, and they're longtime friends, good friends of Terry's, so we appreciate that they're here.
Thank you.
Michael Oldfather, we're pleased that our son, Paul Oldfather, has visited us for the weekend, and not just because he's strong and able to help us do things we couldn't do by ourselves.
I'm taking this opportunity quickly while my hubby is out getting car seats, but it is his birthday today, so if you see him, please wish him a happy birthday.
Oh, great.
Well, I see my friends Bonnie and Nick Zach sitting next to me here, and Bonnie is Kaya's piano teacher, so she's excited to see her.
Yay! Good morning. I'm Sue Prey, and I have two joys. I had a new grandbaby born, a girl to my youngest son, Dan, so when I had two sons, I now have two granddaughters. And also, after 5 months of no kitty in my house, I have a new kitty because of Kalina, wherever she is. Anyway, it's a long story, but her name is Franchella, and she's a calico, 6 pounds, full grown.
Great.
So anyway, two joys.
Great news. Okay, thank you for sharing all of these wonderful thoughts of the week. And we know there might be other things that are on people's hearts and minds, and even those that are unspoken, we will carry with us, and we will think of all of our friends and family here at the UU throughout the week. I'd like to invite the kids to come up to the front now for the story of all ages. Lindsay Smith will be reading Ferdinand the Bull.
Right, is this on? Can people hear me? This story doesn't have any pictures, unfortunately, because we couldn't find the book. But it's kind of an interesting little story about a bull. And I'm assuming most of you know what a bull is. You know, it's got the horns, and he's out there in the field. And he's kind of big, like a, you know, hangs out with the cows. And his name is Ferdinand. You like that name, Ferdinand?
Yeah.
Okay, well, this is kind of a story about... It's funny, yeah. Ferdinand is a bull, and he lives in Spain. Do you know where Spain is? The country Spain, some of you? Mexico. No, Spain is an old, old country, European. Okay, this is the story of Ferdinand. Once upon a time in Spain, there was a little bull, and his name was Ferdinand. All the other little bulls he lived with would run and jump and butt their heads together. But not Ferdinand. He liked to sit just quietly and smell the flowers. He had a favorite spot out in the pasture under a cork tree. It was his favorite tree, and he would sit in its shade all day and smell the flowers. Sometimes his mother, who was a cow, would worry about him. She was afraid he would be lonesome all by himself. And she would say, "Why don't you run and play with the other little bulls and skip and butt your head?" she would say. But Ferdinand would shake his head. "I like it better here, where I can sit just quietly and smell the flowers." His mother saw that he was not lonesome, and because she was an understanding mother, even though she was a cow, She let him just sit there and be happy. As the years went by, Ferdinand grew and grew until he was a very big, strong bull. Remember, bulls have horns. Big, strong. All the other bulls who had grown up with him in the same pasture would fight each other all day. They would butt each other and stick each other with their horns. What they wanted most of all was to be picked to fight at the bullfights in Madrid. So Madrid is the main city in Spain. But not Ferdinand. He still liked to sit just quietly under the cork tree and smell the flowers. One day, five men came in very funny hats to pick up the biggest, fastest, roughest bull to fight in the bullfights in Madrid. So can you picture five funny guys coming up in big hats, walking pretty funny? All the other bulls ran around snorting and butting, leaping and jumping, so the men would think that they were very strong and fierce and pick them. Ferdinand knew that they would pick him, and he didn't care. I'm sorry, Ferdinand knew that they wouldn't pick him, and he didn't care. So he wound out to his favorite cork tree to sit down. He didn't look where he was sitting, and instead of sitting on the nice cool grass in the shade, he sat on a bumblebee.
Ouch!
Well, if you were a bumblebee and a bull sat on you, what would you do? You would sting him. And that is just what the bee did to Ferdinand. Wow, did it hurt! Ferdinand jumped up with a snort. He ran around puffing and snorting, butting and pawing the ground as if he were crazy. The five men saw him, and they all shouted with joy. Here was the largest and fiercest bull of all, just the one for the bullfights in Madrid. So they took him away for a bullfight in a cart. What a day it was. Flags were flying, bands were playing, and all the lovely ladies had flowers in their hair. They had a parade into the bull ring. First came the bandoleros with long, sharp pins with ribbons on them to stick in the bull and make him mad. Next came the picadores, who rode skinny horses, and they had long spears to stick in the bull and make him madder. Then came the matador. So a matador, the proudest of all, and he thought he was also very handsome, he bowed to the ladies. He had a red cape and a sword, and was supposed to stick the bull last of all. Then came the bull. And you know who that was, don't you? Ferdinand? Right. They call him Ferdinand the Fierce. And all of the banderillos were afraid of him. And the picadores were afraid of him. And the matador was scared stiff. Ferdinand ran to the middle of the ring, and everyone shouted and clapped because they thought he was going to fight fiercely and butt and snort and stick his horns around. But not Ferdinand. When he got to the middle of the ring, he saw the flowers and all the lovely ladies' hair, and he just sat down quietly and smelled. He wouldn't fight and be fierce, no matter what they did. He just sat and smelled. And the banderillos were mad, and the picadores were madder, and the matador was so mad he cried because he couldn't show off with his cape and sword. So they had to take Ferdinand home, and for all I know, he is sitting there still under his favorite cork tree, smelling the flowers just quietly. He is very happy. So kind of the moral of the story is that Ferdinand was kind of like an artist and very creative. And he did his own thing. And he didn't worry about the people or the matador or the bullfights or anything. He was happy. And he stopped to smell the flowers all the time.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Our hearts go with you. Go in joy. Our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Thank you.
Go with you. Go in joy. Our hopes go too. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do.
Each day I witness the generosity and talent of this community. Please share as you can to build this beloved community. As I mentioned, we're very fortunate today to have the talented Terry Schmidt with us. She'll be speaking and showing images of art, both others and her own. Professor Terry Schmidt teaches printmaking and drawing at Kansas State University in Manhattan. She has also taught at Washington State, Arbroath, am I saying that right? Arbroath, Scotland, and Norwich, England, as well as guest lectured in numerous states. Terry received her BA and MA from Central Washington University in drawing and printmaking, and her MFA from Washington State University. Her work is held in numerous collections, public and private, around the world. In her own words, Professor Schmidt has said of her work, "I love the spontaneity of gesture, so connected to impulse and intimacy. I employ light, transparency, and spatial movement as I work. Drawing brings to my life a heightened sense of the now." I'd like to welcome Terry and invite her to come on up to the front here. We have, I think we're well set up for her to use her slides, but I'm going to help a little bit too.
This down. Okay, thanks. I think I can see it if I can. Thank you very much for allowing me to come. It warms my heart to be in a group again. Our church is very tiny, and it's so nice to get out. it's hard to get away from home.
Excuse me, but we can't hear you.
There. Can you hear me now? Okay, thank you. Yeah, I was saying it's hard to get away from home, so it's such a pleasure to be here today. And sometimes don't get to be in such a wonderful group of open-minded people. Okay. I'm going to give just a quick talk on and quote from Victor Vasily Kandinsky from Concerning the Spiritual in Art, 1912. And he wrote, Every work of art is the child of its time. Often it is the mother of our emotions. Thus, every period of culture produces its own art, which can never be repeated. Any attempt to give new life to the artistic principles of the past can be at best only resulting in a work of art that resembles a stillborn child. For example, it is impossible for our inner lives, our feelings, to be like those of the ancient Greeks. Efforts, therefore, to apply Greek principles, e.g., to sculpture, can only produce forms similar to those employed by the Greeks, a work that remains soulless for all time. This is a quote from Kandinsky, and a very, very well-known painter. I should have probably included a slide of his work. And I just wrote, in other words, we can never do cubism or some other former historical stylization with the same significance. We may love the significance and felt expression of an early 1940s movie such as Casablanca, but to try to use the movie now as it was written and acted would create a comedy at best, a facade of the truth of the movie. Without soul, the work is empty. Strong works bring our lives now into the work with our awareness. I like to do the work because it puts me in the now and not in a speculating position. I am actively attempting to see what I am hoping to see, and that is something I have never seen. And, you know, it keeps me moving to search to find that. My feeling is the more spiritual a work is, the more spiritual a work is, the less materialistic it is. For me, it is a conviction or driving force which searches for the truth. Truth of form, they say. I feel truth is an essence that guides to an aesthetic conclusion. You know when the piece is done, when there is nothing to remove or redraw. I erase a lot, or paint out, or scribble out, or tear up, probably because I like to see what it looks like before leaving it. I go through a lot of paper and gator boards. I paint on gator board. It's a polystyrene on two sides of foam core, which makes it lighter weight to ship. And it's just as permanent as canvas. I can identify with many works of the painter Alberto Giacometti in his struggle to get to the core, or the best sculpture, or form an image, or composition. His work was linear, not fully colored or shaded, stripped bare of excess, like a linear skeleton. The work has integrity with no contrived conclusions. I like the abstract expressionists of the 70s through the 80s, Philip Guston, as well as the minimalist Ellsworth Kelly, earlier artist Piet Mondrian drew chrysanthemums, 30 drawings in all, not excluding a single petal, until he concluded one was to interpret nature instead of compete with it, hence his boogie-woogie painting of the 1940s, when coming to America to escape Nazi Germany, like so many artists. Art and its spiritual significance are first and foremost in the expression of our times and our ability to reflect and express God's guidance and goodness, his infinite creative capacity to express through us his goodness. Mainstream works of art are less burdened with materialism. The darker works, more grotesque works, seem to force the cultural struggles to the surface to be dealt with, such as Goya's Disasters of War and Katie Kollowitz's Downtrodden Mothers and Infants during wartime. Great art is not always works in pain and sorrow, nor is it always whimsical and upbeat, beautiful. In fact, most works reach us by expressive, emphatic connections, something deep in each of us that the whole image reaches. pure and unexploited by side trips to specifics. A provocative shape, line, color, and texture. Simple placement of parts of the composition. Subject matter gives way to overall compositional and media workings. The works are not always, but many times, abstract and less traditional in production methods. Today, artists seem to need new methods and mediums and attempt at the same time the use of empathy of form, just as always. Some things never change. Truth of form and the search for new ways of finding it for ourselves. And I have a few slides, several, and I'll try to move quickly so you can see. I hope I was loud enough. I don't notice that. Okay. I'm going to show those. Let's see, where is that? Yeah, I'll just. This is a drawing by Jacopo Pontormo, 14th century, and it's the Three Graces, and it holds in it, in that period, it represented the way people felt and saw. And I think that's an idealism of a kind. And again, we have different ways of looking at of form. And I think the contrapposto, the sensitivity of the line, the variation. If we look at Michelangelo's drawing, the transitions from foreground to background, the immersion into the field. And I think, again, the beauty is, at that time, you know, a needed exploration. Work moves that way. This is a good example of what artists cherished at that time. And, of course, investigating foreshortening, again, shading, again, the idea of form and structure. We still have that. This is a drawing by Gericault, and again, Theodore Gericault is working with form and volume, and you can see on the far left, there's an example of the way he started each of the drawings, and in linear form, it's quicker, and it's gestural. Again, the gesture became quite a virtue in the 20th century, and this is a painting, a drawing, actually, with ink by Hans Hofmann, contemporary artist, who influenced most of New York, and all of his students became famous in the United States. Early line work by Picasso. This is a portrait of Stravinsky. And again, the line becomes very strong and not really varying like the Pontormo or the gesture of Hofmann. Such a beautiful variety of types of approaches to art. This is Ellsworth Kelly. Again, one of my heroes. I think because of the purity of his form, he drew many, many, many plants, very singular in the line, and his own work is totally abstract and quite unlike this. But I loved his drawings because of the sensitivity he felt for and the purity and the feeling of the individual plants and the leaves and the shapes. His interest in drawing and finding through nature that pure perfection made him draw every petal on those drawings he did, 30 of them, of the chrysanthemums, and then concluding that he better let nature take care of that. And he would, you know, do it his own way, which he went totally geometric. Also, Rembrandt. Rembrandt's textures, Giacometti's transparency. If we look at his structural emphasis and how he worked with almost as an automobile, you know, looking at the structure and the way things form from the outside in. And structure itself becomes a major, major consideration in the arts. the structure of the composition. This is a portrait. It's actually a drawing in class that Richard Diebenkorn did during a class time in Stanford University. And if you look at this drawing carefully, you can see all the triangular shapes that he's literally sketching out for you to see. Look at the numbers of triangles. Even the entire format forms two very large triangular shapes. And it's interesting how, you know, working from ink and wash, you know, very unusual media together with pencil. This is a Rico Lebrun, you know, the beggar. And again, the triangular shapes, the transitional tones of the ancient, much earlier, more classical period, using all the things we've learned from the past and putting them in, and really breaking tradition when we look at this drawing by Vincent van Gogh. And again, his interest in biting into the edges of the shape, and you can see the pressure from the outside shape. The white moves toward the figure. Also, not really relying on proportion for the strength of the work as much as an exaggeration. Exaggeration, expressive exaggeration, Oscar Kokoschka is a king in that line. If you look at his line when he draws the old professor, you can tell looking at his expression here how the man is so mental. He's barely physical. And again, I love the differences in artists. This is Henri Matisse, a whimsical Frenchman, and light and buoyant and very exaggerated, and no one has hands like that. you know, it's like a rag. If we look at the other end of the trick, we have Sigmund Freud's grandson, Lucian Freud, who just died a few years ago, and is a realist beyond belief. Every crack and crevice in his mother's face, every mole, you know, he misses nothing, you know. And the beauty of it all, regardless of the look, and on and on. Here is a positive-negative relationship with Jack Twerkoff, who worked in the 1960s and 70s. And you can see the way the background moves in and out of the foreground, and the black becomes underneath the white. I really like Susan Rothenberg and the way she's removed. The horse is barely there anymore. It's behind the frontal plane. If we look at, you know, Robert Motherwell, who's a totally abstract artist, didn't become a painter until he was 50, which really encourages me. He worked as an art historian, a brilliant art historian and a writer, and gave it all up and became a painter, and now is considered one of the greatest of all in the 20th century. His painting here is an homage to the Spanish Republic. It's one of that series. And I love the shapes. I think shapes, transparency, line value, all of these things, the flatness of form, the three-dimensional, the illusionistic, in this case, he's really interpreting, this is Egon Schiele, an artist in the, I guess he worked around the 1920s through the 30s. And he's, you know, he's responding to Van Gogh in this portrait, self-portrait, that is actually his room. And if you look at the way he's repeating these geometric shapes and composing, he's very interested in the composition, the value pattern, even more than what it is. Richard Diebenkorn, probably my all-time hero, other than Rembrandt, you know, working with color, and I don't think the color is clearly visible as I can see it on the screen. His color is like that of Matisse. I like the way he likes Matisse. And I think, you know, if we look at that, this is William de Kooning, a linear drawing. William de Kooning, a painting on black with white, almost finding reversal, you know, as a challenge. Artists find challenges, and I think one of the things that's so important in our strivings to do the work we do is that search, and that search is to find the truth, the truth in that form. And I think so many people, if you look at this picture, it's William de Kooning drawing a woman. Well, he doesn't really hate women, but he used their structure, because he liked women, for his search for composition. And in this case, he's just tearing it apart and trying to find that, just as Giacometti did in this case, a drawing, a portrait. This is a self-portrait by Jim Dine, who is alive and well and still living in New York. And again, a charcoal drawing. These are all drawings of artists, by artists, that I'm crazy about. And I'm, you know, showing you some that have influenced my own work. Another Jim Dine, done on frosted acetate with charcoal, and just pushed against the wall in the Nelson Atkins Art Museum about 20 years ago, I think, maybe 15 years ago. It's hard to know. The years seem to fly by. This is a William de Kooning, and I love the placement of the composition and the way it's just torn apart. A drawing I did of a friend who came into my studio when I was at a residency. She was telling me of the Holocaust. She was very elderly, and everyone came in to hear her. And so I drew while everyone else talked. And this is her, Sophie, Catching Sophie, it's called. And this is my roommate, Sharon. This is called, what is this called? Sharon's, when you're sick and you're trying to recover. Yes, convalescence. I like that word. This is charcoal. This is graphite. Graphite. Another graphite drawing. I did a lot of figure drawings, and this is early on when I moved to Kansas. This is Val's rocker, and I loved her Birkenstocks. This is Flowers for Duchamp, and I, you know, always loved Duchamp's wearing of soap suds as hair and all kinds of different things. He was a little bit ahead of his time. This is a more current drawing. This is Reaching. It's called Reaching. And when my folks died, I tried to find them, you know, and I think they had moved on and had got home. They'd gone home to God. So I felt like maybe they're somewhere there. This is a drawing around the same time. This is called, Breakfast on the North Sea. I took students to Scotland at this time, and we had a breakfast room. You can see the coffee maker there in the corner. And the light was just unbelievable that came in from the North Sea into our castle. This is another residency. It's called Vermont Window, and there was a moving water wheel that thrashed everything around, and I lived in a room above this old mill, and that was my first drawing. This is my first move toward complete abstraction. This is just out of my head, drawing in the studio. When you don't have anything to draw from, then you're forced to draw. And I think that's when I started moving away from feeling like it had to follow the form and structure of things that were in front of me, icons. And I started just dealing with the mark. One mark leads to another. And sure enough, I began to make some pictures that I didn't throw away or tear up. And this one's called Ein Heldenleben, and I named it after Richard Strauss' symphony that I loved so much. This is called Best Shot. The idea of speed and movement. This is ice something or other. These are larger drawings in graphite on gatorboard. This is called Music Box. And again, music and how we hear it and feel it. And this is called, I don't remember the name of this one. Anyway, it was in a show in Seattle with my first gallery there. And it was purchased right away. And I thought, geez, you know, the one I didn't like was sold first. And I'm always surprised, you know. Abstraction to me became an important part of understanding real structure. Real structure is the wholeness or the actual emotion that I'm hoping to feel and portray. This is called River Bend. These are the new ones, a few new pieces, and they're they're small. They're only 9 by 12. Some of them are 14 by 17. This is just graphite. This one's graphite. It's called Summer Sonata. And again, music has been a major, major part of my life. My mother played piano as early as I can remember. And this is walking wire. This is a solar etching from a drawing, because I couldn't do the same thing with the etch. A needle didn't produce the same effect. This is a dry point in Vermont at the Vermont Studio Center from my window, it's called, or the bridge from my window. This is in the room of colors, and this is when I started moving to color with oil crayon. And I feel like, again, the search was bringing all the artists that I have ever been exposed to into a situation in my mind when I'm working. And as they say, and people have said this many times, one by one they left, and I was able to find myself by continuing to work. This is called Harvest Moon. It's a very large painting with wash, watercolor, and acrylic. This is a much smaller drawing on paper. It's called The Watchman Waits. And I'm always feeling like I'm waiting for something to happen in the work. This is a painting that, again, on paper, more paintings. This is a crayon drawing. And you can see the color over there better. The color, I don't think, shows up at all. Yeah, the color isn't showing up. So, and you can turn that around if they want to see it, you know. So, yeah, the color is really quite a bit different. Anyway, these are all new, and they're really, you know, hopefully I'm learning to not compartmentalize all my shapes. I, at the same time, feel like the importance of individual colors is still not clear to me, and I wish to continue finding each of them as well as their relationship to one another. And these are landscape-inspired works of art, and from Dylan Thomas and T.S. Eliot. This is City on a Hill. And again, working with more texture and more paint. Okay, and I think that's it. And I hope, I would be interested in some questions if anyone has any questions. This is where I am now, so I, you know, hope to continue working.
I'll go ahead and get this out of the way. Thank you very much for the happy birthday wishes. When you're just free drawing and you don't have anything in mind, you said you just one mark leading to another mark leading to another mark. Do you ever catch yourself kind of in the pattern of drawing the same general type or theory, or are you able to flex your theory throughout several, I guess, art genres?
Well, I go through a lot of different things. It just, you know, and I try to respond to my environment, where I am, what's happening. But more than anything, I think I many times look through lots and lots of magazines, not to lift the ideas from the artist, but to actually rekindle in myself some of the things that I'm so excited about. William de Kooning's work, his gesture, just inspires me to no end. the dance that he portrays, in whether he's using paint or line, inspires me. And I, you know, many times will just review that in my head. But and at the same time, it doesn't matter whether it's representational work. Again, I'm inspired by Rembrandt. His etchings were some of the first works that I remember thinking, gee, I'm going to do this. And, you know, seeing his landscapes as a child. And then going out on the riverbank with my pen and ink and trying to see as he saw, you know. Not copying his work. I copied cartoons for years out of books, you know, just to get acquainted with what they're doing, you know. And then I got tired of that, and I had to do my own thing. Today, children, students, children to me, I'm such a, you know, an old lady, so they tend to appropriate what they call appropriate works of art, which I think is just flat out stealing. And I think one of the reasons we need to move, I feel like we need to move back to applauding our own natural instinct to draw as we wish. I always encourage everyone, don't use color crayon books. Use drawing paper or paper of some sort. Or, you know, tear it up, you know, draw with scissors, draw with something other than, you know, staying in all the lines. And I didn't use crayon books as a kid. And when we had them and I saw everyone else's work, I thought, well, what would they have done if they didn't have all those lines restricting them? So I encourage people. That's off your question.
Well, that's interesting to hear your thoughts about appealing to our instinctual feelings. I know that you had, at one time, a classes in Aggieville for children. And I've always loved children's art, and someone once pointed out to me, and then I started really noticing my kids' art. They have a natural sense of balance, and also they use the whole page, and they have the colors and the shapes bounce around to pull your eye all around. Do you want to talk about your theory when you were teaching your class? I mean, I found that really fascinating.
Yes. When I taught children, we had every Saturday we'd have the kids and they'd come running up the stairs. It was the old opera house behind Shooters, above Shooters Sporting Goods, which is now gone. And I don't know what's in the place of it now. I guess the old Chicago restaurant or something. Anyway, it was a big, big building, and up above we had high ceilings, and the children would come running up the stairs, and we'd roll out a big roll of paper on the floor. It was a gigantic hardwood floors, and we had projector we showed slides of artists' work, Picasso, Matisse, many, many wonderful, colorful things, and we had flowers. And we had them in the middle of the paper, and we told them, now look at the flowers, and you can do what you want with the paint. And the students loved it, and their parents loved us, because they'd bring the children for 2.5-3 hours. They'd come back, and the children were gone, and the parents could play, you know. And the children, I remember Emily Seton came in, and she was 4 years old, and she sat down, and she cried and cried. She was not going to leave her mama. And her mama left, and I put a brush in her hand that had paint on it. I said, this has paint. And I remember her looking at me and looking at the paint, and she just went to town on that paper. I mean, she wanted everything. And she wanted all the colors. And we had all the colors mixed up ahead, red, yellow, blue, and so on, and we did the primaries, tertiaries, and black and white, and they could just add as they chose. At the end of that class period, her mother was there, and she went, oh, no, and she started crying. She did not want to leave. And I know that's, you know, so often the case, you know. There's so much in us that wants to explore those things that inspire us. And I think that inspiration, that expression, that feeling is a driving force that's coming from within. It's in us. And it's in us because we're blessed with that. I know that's a word everybody uses instead of God, but you know, I feel like I know there's one mind. I know there's one mind, and that mind gives each and every one of us similar connections, and that's where the empathy for the work, I feel, and this is my feeling, comes from. And so I'm so grateful to God for feeling this feeling when I'm working. And I'm not always happy when I'm working. Sometimes it's a major struggle, but I'm also understanding, you know, that, you know, it's not my big fat ego, which gets to be very big at times, that's the driving force behind it. I feel like there's really one mind. So
Gene Severs, I'm guessing you maybe repressed a few years ago of one of your drawing two classes and figure drawing class where I was a student of yours. With my limited abilities as a draftsman, I do want to credit you as an influence on what I picked up with the gesture that was so obvious and important in your 2D work, and feel that was a major influence in me developing my gestural pottery forms and with their figurative or natural character. I very much respect teachers, and particularly college art teachers, because I think their challenge is unique in that they deal with students coming in who unfortunately our public education has such a limited capability and perspective on art. At one end of the spectrum, you have art in schools that is treated with no more respect than a study hall. And then I was blessed with a middle-sized school in Kansas that actually had two full-time art teachers. But I think it's a particular challenge to yourself and others at the university level, where the students, whether they're in drawing one or a graduate level, have such a diverse range of abilities and life experience, where to be truly effective, as I would credit you as being, it's an ultimate challenge to relate to each person as an individual, and that it's the overall scheme of things that helps that person in develop their art skills and their life skills. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gene. I have to say that Gene's sculpture and his ceramics have been a major, major strength in some of the graduate work produced in our department. And since then, he's become such a big help to us in the wood shop, and all the things he repairs, and his ability to rise to the occasion of every need from students and help them with things they've never been exposed to. I'm really grateful for that. He's been consistently there for all of us. And, teaching is hard. Yeah. It really is. And I think, you know, trying to meet people where they are and help them move ahead. Mostly, I'm a cheerleader. And I think that's, again, that's, hopefully that's coming from that, you know, that strength of spirituality that we are all a part of. And I feel like that's the most important thing in what I do. Hopefully it's helpful to people. And I know Lindsay has wonderful work. He's extremely talented and has been a big help to everyone at the art museum in so many ways. And hanging work, being aesthetically sensitive to where he puts work in a gallery, makes a huge difference in how we receive the work, the layout. So Sylvia is a major artist, too, Sylvia Beeman. And I just want to, you know, say her work expresses so much, you know. I could talk all about all the artists here. How many of you are artists in this room? How many of you do art? I know Bonnie Zak is a musician. Nick Zak is a an inventor, a carpenter, a sculptor. His drawings are inspiring to me. They're sketches of ideas, and his children are so talented, and I've worked with them also in little ways.
Thank you, Terry. That was tremendous. Thank you so much, Terry, for being with us today and sharing your work, and not only your work, but your incredibly deep knowledge of art and your reflections on what it means to bring it forward and be an artist in the 21st century. Would you please now stand as you are able and join in singing hymn number 329, Life Has Loveliness to Sell. Our closing words come from the writings of Sarah Moores Campbell, Unitarian minister and author of the 1990 UUA Meditation Guide, Into the Wilderness. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts they are, and, renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. May you move boldly into your week. Thank you.